Tonight we have a very special guest. I can tell from the crowd that you kind of know that we have a special guest. You know, what's really special about her, I ask her, you know, describe your background. How will I describe your background? And she gives me this. She says she comes from an English, Quaker, Irish, Catholic, Lutheran, Jewish, Midwestern, Socialist, Journalist family. And I thought, well, okay, that's a little more elaborate than I expected, but it just shows the diversity of herself. By the way, she is the person. She has a long history as a lawyer. She's been involved in the National Lawyers Guild for many years. She's now executive director of the Micklejohn Civil Liberties Institute. I encourage everyone to check out their website at www.mcli.org. Working on civil liberties. But Anne Fagan Ginger is the person that you'd want on your team when they come after you for having radical ideas. She's a lawyer, a professor, activist, and she is the author or editor of 24 books. Cold War Against Labor books are back in the back and for sale if one wants to look at them and purchase them. She has argued and won a case in the U.S. Supreme Court back in 1959 against the Ohio Un-American Activities Committee. She is a very active person on human rights and civil liberties issues and is a leading scholar in our land. So we are very honored to have Anne Fagan Ginger speak to us tonight. Let's welcome her.
Well, the real truth is this is the first speech I've given since I lost the sight of my right eye. And so you'll listen to me and not watch my glasses. I'm going to say at various times, I may or may not put them on like this, and I have this in front of it. It's the same thing your dentist uses. If you have bad eyesight, it's a very good way to help you read. However, all that was before I lost this right eye, which is, as I say, the first time I've made a speech since then, so I'm going to use my glasses, not use my glasses, stand on my head and do various other things, and I hope the main thing that comes across is the content and not my eyeglasses, but we shall wait and see about that. And if any of you are young enough, if you eat a lot of greens, allegedly you will not get macular degeneration, which I recommend. So, thank you for the introduction. I think that Marx and Engels and Lenin did not foresee certain things. And I'm not saying that no Marxist since that time has thought about these subjects or done research on them. But I do think that it makes a difference that they, in their basic writing, I don't think they ever saw a military-industrial complex at the same time that you had a civil, non-military capitalist system. And that, I think, is what we now have under Bush and Cheney, which we've had for a while. But this military-industrial complex is capitalism with certain aspects of undemocratic and so forth that is separate from the capitalism on the civilian side and the governmental system on the non-military side. And I don't think they foresaw that, and I don't know how many of you have thought about that, but it's part of what I think about, and I think it makes a difference. I do not think that they foresaw the development of nuclear weapons that can actually destroy all life on the planet. I don't think in their era they thought of that. I don't think they either foresaw ecological disaster, that is, that the air will be so thick that you can't breathe and the water will rise in the oceans because of the petroleum and the destruction of the ecosystem. I do not think they foresaw that. I don't think they foresaw a United Nations organization consisting of countries that were socialist, non-socialist, dictatorships, military, democracy, colonies, or former colonies. I don't think they foresaw that structure of the United Nations. I don't think they foresaw an international criminal court, which we now have, the International Court of Justice, which at this moment is debating whether or not Israel building the walls is legal or illegal under international law, that kind of an issue. which earlier decided that Iran owed money to the U.S. because of taking the hostages, which earlier decided that the U.S. owed money to Nicaragua because of the help that the U.S. gave to the Contras. I don't think they foresaw that structure of an international court of justice that could take up any issue raised by the General Assembly, which I don't think they also foresaw, in which one nation had one vote, and that number of nations could be as high as 180 or 189 as it is today. Nor do I think they foresaw an international criminal court. It's true the U.S. says we're not going to go in it, but there is going to be, or there is now, an international criminal court which can try any person in the world who they can get hold of who is guilty of certain crimes under international law, genocide, crimes against peace, crimes against humanity, crimes against war crimes, as in the Nuremberg Principles. I don't think that they foresaw these structural major types of development. I do not criticize them in any way for this. I think that they did remarkably well from where they were coming from to get as far as they got. But I think it means that we have to think anew. The dialectical materialism, the method by which you come to a decision, was magnificent. And that's what I think we have to do. But I do not think we're going to find the answers that we desperately need in the United States in the year 2004 and in the city of Sacramento with a man in the, whatever you call it, governorship, like we've never had before. I think this is a new era for people in Sacramento, for people in California, for people in the United States, for people in the world. And so I think we need to use the method that they used and talk about the fundamental economic issues, but not to assume that the structures or the particular things that they expected to have happen, the developments, would happen the way that they may have expected. I wanted to talk about using dialectical materialism on ruling class actions since 9/11, what has happened, and how can we affect the result? How can we act, not simply react? Who can do this? In what ways? Using what tactics? What has happened since 9/11? We have a book there called How to Use New Civil Rights Laws After 9/11. And what has happened is that the rights of the people have been denied. I think, are any of you librarians? Anybody read a book? Do you want to have your name attached to that book and given to the CIA or the FBI each time you go to the library? How many of you read a newspaper? Do you want every media person to be concerned that their eyes on them and as to what they do and how they do it? I don't mean that there never were before, but much more than in the past. How many of you have kids in college or grandkids? Do you want them to have any foreign students in the class with them? You know, hundreds of thousands of students are not here this year. I take it you know that, from all over the world. They couldn't get admitted in time. And so it isn't only that you learn by talking to the professor, but you also learn from talking to your fellow students. And if the fellow students are not from certain parts of the world or from certain viewpoints, then your grandkids or your kids are going to be missing part of their education. But in addition to the rights of people, and I haven't even talked about the detainees, the people on Guantanamo, we could go into great length about what has happened. I think all of you have some concept of some of these things. Mickeljohn Institute is now writing a book called Challenging U.S. Human Rights Violations Since 9/11. And we have 28 categories of violations and 140 examples, trying to begin to see the whole picture. And the whole picture is indeed impossible to comprehend, but necessary to comprehend. And so one of the concepts that we're talking about is the rights of the people. Another concept is the duties and commitments of the government. And one of the differences between the U.S. Constitution and the U.N. Charter is that the U.S. Constitution talks about the rights of the people And there are very few places where it says the government has a commitment, is required to do something. One of the things the U.S. government is required to do in the Constitution, not the amendments, just in the Constitution itself. Do you have it right in front of you? You want to read this? Article 1, Section, Article 1, Section 9, U.S. Constitution. Some of you have the pieces of paper I handed out.
The privilege of writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require.
So we didn't have a rebellion, and we didn't have, what's the other, an invasion. And habeas corpus is written into the Constitution. I say that because, as you know, the Constitution really came in two pieces. The Constitution was written, and when, in order to get people to vote for it, they said, well, we'll amend it. And that was agreed, and that's why a lot of working people and ordinary people like ourselves at that time voted for the Constitution, because they said they would amend it, and they put in the first 10 amendments. But even in the Constitution itself, they had to say that they would never do what we are doing in Guantanamo. Does it say except if the military says so? Does it say except if Bush is president? Except if it's on Cuban property rented by the United States government. There are no exceptions. Habeas corpus is habeas corpus. And it's in the fundamental document. And I think it's in... What?
What's habeas corpus?
Thank you. Habeas corpus means that if you are arrested by anybody, you immediately have a right to know who arrested you and why. And it's interesting, because I've had people arrested for deportation in the McCarthy period. It could happen now. And so I filed a petition for the writ of habeas corpus, and it was called United States ex rel on the relation of my client versus the bailiff. So habeas corpus means the government of California or the U.S. government is suing the jailer on behalf of the detainee, the person arrested, and the government, the jailer, if you win the writ, must tell you why you're being held. It's a very basic concept, and it was this concept that the people demanded even before they got all of the other rights, free speech, free press, and so forth and so on. So, in the U.S. Constitution, we talk about certain rights. In the U.N. Charter, they talk about duties of the government. The government has a duty. And somebody got Article 55 of the U.N. Charter. You got it over here? You want to read it? It's near the bottom of the page. You have it there? On the U.N. Charter side. Article 55. You want to read this Article 55 over here?
With a view to the creation of conditions of stability and well-being, which are necessary for peaceful and friendly relations among nations, based on respect for the principle of equal rights and self-determination of peoples, the United Nations shall promote.
Now listen to that. This is saying, for these reasons, the United Nations shall promote. What does it say in the First Amendment? Shall not abridge. That's a double negative. Fifth Amendment, it says, shall not deny. Double negative. 14th Amendment, shall not deny, double negative. This is 150 years later. Now they're saying the United Nations shall promote. That's an affirmative. And as you listen to this, where it says the United Nations shall promote these things, please be aware that Article 56 says, are you back there? Do you have Article 56? You want to read it to us?
56 says, all members pledge themselves to take joint and separate action in cooperation with the organization for the achievement of the purpose set forth in Article 55.
In other words, everything he's about to read us that the United Nations shall promote, the United States as a member of the UN agreed to promote. So it isn't just, yes, it isn't just that the United Nations shall promote. You can put in the word United States shall promote. So the United States shall promote A,
higher standards of living, full employment and conditions of economic and social progress and development. B, solutions of international economic, social, health, and related problems, and international and educational cooperation. and C, universal respect for and observance of human rights and fundamental freedoms for all without distinction as to race, sex, language, or religion.
So this is what was written down in 1945. And I want to be very clear. How many of you were around in San Francisco in 1945? Good. I was not in San Francisco, and I paid no attention to the UN at all at that time. It didn't hit me until many years later when I found out, I mean, I'm a lawyer, you'd think I would have, I was in law school, was never mentioned. But it turns out the United Nations Charter is a treaty. That's the nature of that document. The U.S. Constitution is a constitution. The United Nations Charter is a treaty. Do you want to read me Article 6, Clause 2 of the U.S. Constitution there? You got it over there? Near the top of the page on the Constitution side. Article 6. Go ahead. Yep.
Okay, this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby.
Now this is the joke. The United Nations Charter is a treaty. It's not just a damn sheet of paper that a bunch of people signed for some reason in 1940. It is a treaty. It is the supreme law of the land, and the judges in the state and federal court shall enforce it. Now, what I've just said is not known, as far as I know, to Scalia or Rehnquist, certainly not to Bush or any of the... But this is actually fundamental. And when they wrote the Constitution, they knew they would make treaties. I mean, Bush knows that any agreement about international copyright, I mean, that's to be obeyed. And NAFTA and GATT, which aren't even treaties, but just agreements, shall be obeyed. I am telling you, when they wrote the UN Charter, it was a treaty, it was part of the supreme law of the land, and the Secretary of State, Stettinius, knew that that was true, and we copied his article, his letter to President Truman in our book, How to Use New Civil Rights Laws, because he made clear they were serious. The other thing I wanted to be quite clear about is they had no choice in 1945 but to write this kind of language. The people of the world had suffered through World War I, and they cleaned up and straightened out and got reorganized and rebuilt their cities, and then they were destroyed in World War II. And it was clear to the capitalist, imperialist rulers of the world, as well as to the people in the Soviet Union and other places that were seeking a new answer, it was clear that the people of the world would not clean up again and rebuild again if they thought there'd be another war in 20 years. So there was no, they had no alternative. When they wrote those words, they wrote them because they had to write them. It wasn't something that they did just to be nice. And they meant them at that time. Now, this Article 55 and 56 is a commitment. The member nations, the United States and other member nations, shall promote these things. That means go forth and do them. And it was a serious, actual commitment. And I think that it is critical that we use that at all moments. In addition, after another kind of law was passed, how many of you ever heard of an excess profits tax? My friends, in World War I, people were so anti-big business that the United States government, La Follette was for it, but he wasn't the one who got it through. They actually passed a law saying every contract for military spending cannot have a higher profit than a contract before military spending. If this is when the war began and the profit was such and such a percent and the war began, you can't now put another thing on top, another piece of profit. They actually passed that. They actually collected money. The budget of the United States government in 19-something, and I don't want to tell you which year because I'll get it wrong, but I think 1918, some percentage, and it was a large percentage, like 40% of the income of the United States government came from excess profits taxes. The government taxed the excess profit that the corporation was charging for, you know, things that they sold to the military. Do you think we had an excess profits tax in World War II? No. We did. And it brought in 23%. I may have the percents wrong because I haven't got my notes. 23% or some enormous part of the total budget of the United States government from 1940 until 1947. That's literally the truth. Do you think we had an, you're going to get this one right, do you think we had an excess profits tax in the Korean War?
Yes.
We did. We actually did. And that's when it ended. If we now convinced, I don't know who your congresswoman is, a man, who is your? Okay. That person, and your senator obviously is Barbara Boxer, and she's running for office, those people could now put a motion in Congress to have an excess profits tax on every contract that involves any military matter, whether it's Afghanistan or former Yugoslavia or Iraq or any other place, or Colombia or Philippines or wherever we are. And it would be highly appropriate. It's not radical. It's old-fashioned. It's not a new idea. They ended. They were for a term of years, and they were not continued.
Well, now we guarantee it.
Right. Exactly the opposite. Okay. The reality is that the economic well-being of women has gone down since 9/11 in general. The economic well-being of youth. How many of you know a person under the age of 30 who's unemployed at this time? Absolutely. How many times do people mention it?
Often.
Well, among the people I know, they never mention it. They act as if it isn't happening, and they'll get a job tomorrow, which is not accurate. So the well-being of women, the well-being of young people, the well-being of children, the well-being of people who are getting out of prison and who need some steps so that they won't feel that they have to go do something that will cause them to go back in prison. The economic well-being of immigrants, the well-being of people who look like Middle Eastern, all of these standards are going down. And we all know what's happening to the educational system. The number of people in the classrooms has gone up. The number of thoughts in the books has gone down. And this is not a way to build toward the future. So the question is, what are we doing in this setup? What we are doing is reacting to what they do. They've got a plan, and we've slowly seeing it. It was written down 40 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, in things we didn't read. They know what they're going to do between now and November. I mean, I could make some guesses. One, I'm afraid, is something called Cuba. I mean, that's a possibility. One is something called Venezuela. One is something maybe called more Colombia, maybe more Philippines, and more inner city shooting or rubber bullets at people who are protesting. So we have been reacting to their system, and we're not going to win that way. We're not even going to stop them. We've got to figure out what we think is possible and find a way to promote these affirmative things before they think of them. We have I wrote my notes large, but nonetheless. Oh, that's what I'm talking about. How many of you are in a group that does something about education, that does something about the environment, that does something about nuclear weapons, does something about immigrant rights, does something about veterans' rights, does something about labor unions? Friends, the problem that we now have is that somebody's so busy doing this that they have no time to do this. And the people doing this are not talking to the people who are doing this, and when they're doing this, they're never mentioning that. And when they're doing this, they're never mentioning that. And they're saying, how can I talk about that when I'm busy talking about this? That is not true of Bush and Cheney. They know it is all connected. There's a ruling clique somewhere. We know some of their names. We know some of what they're doing. And they have a plan, and they are deeply intertwined. And if they happen to need a Condoleezza Rice, they draw her in. Or if they happen to need somebody else, they draw them in. We have not come to see that the issue that absolutely gets us is connected to the issue that absolutely gets the next one. And we're going to go through a series of laws, and you'll see they are the same laws that apply all across the board. And one of the things that I think we have to do with the law is to see that until we all walk together, none of us will get there. If we walk tomorrow, is it a Saturday, against the war in Iraq, then we're going to have to walk, some of us, on Monday to the city council for a bigger budget on schools and so forth and so on. And it's this commonality that I think we have to have. We have to work together. We have to see that the issues are similar and that you are not going to win by fighting very hard for this without making a connection with that. And it's not popular, but it can be done. We need to act using new tactics. I bought a red hat. That's my new tat. I knew somebody who called them strategy and tatics. So I bought a new hat as a new strategy. I never had a hat before. I never had an expensive red hat. But when I put it on, I looked different than I did without my hat. Now, I'm not saying that that's the right, that it's going to get us very far, but it's how many of you know about the lunchrooms that began the civil rights movement, we say? Well, we need some new lunchrooms. We need to find what it is, what spur will cause young people, middle people, and older people to become more active. We have to find new ways. Now, the young people have found something. It's called email. And Carrie's been using it. Dean was using email in a constructive way. That's a good idea. That's one thought. And young people may, and some other people who can see, will use that. We've boycotted in the past. We've gotten groups of unions together around certain issues. And young people today will often, how many of you are involved with Sacramento State at all? There are young people out doing stuff that we're not doing. They don't even tell us about it. And they do it in a way that I think is wild or wonderful or whatever, but it's different. But they are doing it at least. But at this moment, what we need is to find new ways of using the law. And what I'm suggesting is that there are laws that we can use. How many of you remember Augustus Hawkins, the congressman? Remember Humphrey Hawkins' bill? Does anybody here know the Humphrey Hawkins Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act? Well, friends, that's one of the new laws. It's not a new law. It's a new way of using an old law. Let me tell you a secret. The Humphrey Hawkins Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act is actually a law. It's on the books, 15 United States Code, Section 1022. And it says, believe it or not, that every single year the President of the United States shall make a report to Congress on the rate of unemployment of people, adults, and of people 20 years old and younger. Make a report. Accurate. And then he is required, the President is required, to make a proposal, a plan, that will bring unemployment down to 3% for adults and 4% for people 20 to 14. How many of you knew that? We fought and struggled for a bill, a law. We get it, and then we ignore its enforcement. Now, it happens there's a man in Washington named President Bush, and he did not make that report to Congress. The second fact is, when he made his message on the budget, he is required to propose a method to bring unemployment down to 3% and 4%, and he could talk about doing it through private industry, but he must come forward with what I'm calling a WPA plan if it isn't going to be done by big business. That's required in the law. And the reality is, he didn't do it. The unemployment rate today, we know officially, is what, 5.6? A couple weeks ago it was 5.8. We know that it's going up, and we know that isn't an accurate rate because the reality is many people have stopped looking for work. We know that the unemployment rate in many communities is far above 5.6 or 5.8. But no matter how you slice it, it is not down to 3 or 4%, and he is doing nothing whatever to bring it down, and he's not talking about it. That's an offense. Whether it's impeachable or not, I can't answer, and I'm not saying they would impeach him for it. But I am saying you have an opportunity to use this law. You're not doing anything radical. I don't know whether that's good or bad. But the reality is This is the law. It's on the books. It's never been repealed, and it's very explicit, 3% and 4%. So they're lying about the amount of unemployment. They are failing to make a plan to bring it down, and they're not even talking about it. If you look on Google, you can see that the word employment and full employment is nowhere in his annual address, nor is it in his message. So there's a new law, or an old law, that we can use in a new way. In addition to which, now that you've read about habeas corpus, you can demand of the Attorney General of the United States, you can demand of Barbara Boxer, if she wants your vote next November, that she will insist that habeas corpus be given to every single person on Guantanamo Island, every detainee. And every, I don't know whether you know people who've actually been gone to register with the Immigration Service. Do any of you know such people? And they vanished. The Immigration Service then took them from the minute that they went down to register and deported them. And that is a violation of fundamental concepts. You can't hold somebody without saying why they're being held and having a hearing on it. So habeas corpus is one of the other rules that you can make. Then there's a document called the United Nations Charter. Let's see, back there, do you have one? UN Charter there? And I can't see that far. Somebody back here who's got one. Do you want to read us a sort of a humorous two clause three? Just listen to this. This is the law, friends. This is a treaty. We're back to the UN Charter again. 2.3.
All members shall settle their international disputes by peaceful means in such a manner that international peace and security and justice are not in danger.
All members shall settle their disputes by peaceful means. Does it say, again, does it say except U.S.? This is all. Now, do any of you over here have the piece of paper? I passed out a bunch of them. All right, 2.4. Somebody read us 2.4.
All members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations.
Right, the political independence of Iraq is what we're talking about. I'm not saying Iraq had a good government. A lot of other people don't have a good government either. But we've said we will not use force or threat of force to affect the territorial integrity or political independence. The territorial integrity of all of Yugoslavia or former Yugoslavia is screwed up, not through UN action, through action of some people, some nations, which the UN didn't stop. And certainly in Iraq and Afghanistan, we have used force or threat of force against the territorial integrity. That's a violation of law. I mean, let's just be clear. It's a violation of what the President of the United States swore to uphold when he took the oath of office, and so did all of the other government officials. Then there's something called the Nuremberg Principles. How many of you remember the trial of the defendants in Nuremberg after World War II? And they were tried for war crimes, which had existed before. They were tried for crimes against peace. And they were tried for crimes against humanity. And what the United States government is doing today is war crimes, crimes against peace, and crimes against humanity. And all of the nations of the world, and through the General Assembly, voted to adopt the Nuremberg Principles after World War II, after those trials, at the request of President Truman, that the four nations which had agreed to the Nuremberg trials, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and the Soviet Union made that agreement and tried the defendants. And then all of the nations of the world agreed to that set of principles. And that's more law that we should be using. And you can use it in your daily conversation when you're talking about what Bush is doing. It isn't just bad. It isn't only vicious. It isn't only insane. It isn't only making people rich. It is illegal. It is against the fundamental law, both the UN Charter and the Nuremberg Principles. Now let me give you an exam question. Do you think the United States has ever ratified something called the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination? Make a guess. Raise your hand if you think we ever did.
If we ratified it?
Yes. Good. My dear friends, in 1994, the United States Senate ratified a treaty which had been signed long before by President Carter called the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. It is a treaty. Now, you all know part of the supreme law of the land. And this method of enforcement is not nothing. The method of enforcement is by reporting. What the UN Human Rights Treaty say is that you sign a piece of paper that says all of these things, and then you're to make a report under the Racism Convention every 2 years. So the first report was due in 95, we didn't file it. The second report was due in 97, we didn't. 99, we didn't. Finally, we did in 2001, just before, do any of you remember the Durban Conference? I went. And just before the Durban Conference, the UN World Conference Against Racism, the U.S. somehow managed to pull together a report, which they made very briefly. Now, I mention this not only to make fury at the U.S. government, but the fact is the second report under this convention must be at the state and local level. And it is actually true, because I called the Secretary of State's office, and he said, we sent a letter to the governor and attorney general of every state telling them to fill out a report under the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. They didn't do it. And, of course, we don't have the money. This woman actually told me this. We don't have the budget to enforce this. In any event, my friends, the treaty is part of the supreme law of the land. You make a report every 2 years under this convention, and the report must be at the state and local level. Now, what does that mean? How many of you live in Sacramento? How many of you live in the county of Sacramento? Do you realize that you can go to your city council and you can ask them right now to make a report under every article in the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination and send it to the state attorney general? And send it to the State Department of State, and that is what is legally required. We did that in Berkeley. If we can do it in Berkeley, you can do it in Sacramento. We went on a different treaty, which I'll come to. We asked the City Council to authorize the Youth Commission, the Women's Commission, the Labor Commission, and the Police Review Commission to make reports on what they were doing and send them to the State Department. Mickeljohn also got a copy, and then we sent them directly to the UN committee so they'd have them. So it's something that you can do. You use the law. You have the law and you use it. There's a second, I'm giving it away now. Do you think we ever ratify something called the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights? How many think so? You're on the right track. There you go. Well, the reality is, in 1991, a guy named President Bush I went to China, and he said, you have a dismal civil rights record. And they said to him, you're a hypocrite. You've never ratified the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Everybody else virtually has ratified it, and your president signed it long ago, Carter. So Bush came back and said to the Senate, ratify the damn thing, which they did. So that in 1993, the United States owed a report to what's called the Human Rights Committee, which enforces the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And the first report we issued 2 years late in 1995. The second report was due 5 years after the first one, so it was due in 1998. We never issued it. The third report was due 5 years after 1998. We never issued it. But we did get the Berkeley City Council, that's the ordinance of the treaty that we convinced them to do. Now, there's language in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights that you're supposed to protect things. Article 22 protects the rights of labor unions. Article 23 says children are entitled to protection of society and the state. That means you can't just cut the budget if you want to have money enough to do something else in a state or a city. Article 6 says every human being has the inherent right to life. And this can't be taken away for certain, just for light reasons. And the UN committee has ruled that that means that nuclear weapons are illegal. So when the U.S. government makes its report under Article 6 of the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, they have to say how many nuclear weapons they have and what they're doing to get rid of them. And Article 27 says people have a right to exercise their culture, which means the people in Chiapas have been told by the UN committee they have a right to own land. Now, I know this all comes at you out of the blue. I tell you, this has been in the law since 1992, and every senator swore to uphold it, and so did the president, and so did the secretary of state, and we have an opportunity of insisting that they enforce it. Now, you'll get this one right. What do you think about the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment? Ratified. 1994. And the report is required every 3 years. And this goes beyond torture. This says degrading treatment or punishment. And any Marxist or any working person knows that short of torture, there's a lot of degrading treatment. Anybody who's ever been on welfare or gotten any food stamps knows that you can be treated in a degrading manner. And that is against this particular thing. And a treaty, as we said, is part of the supreme law of the land and must be enforced by the courts. And so what I'm suggesting is you have a meeting with your city council members and teach them what I've just been teaching you, every single one of them. I'd have a meeting with your county board of supervisors. Teach them all of this stuff. I'll tell you a joke. The 92nd time you do it, they will learn it. I've been doing it in Berkeley since 1992, and by now they say, oh, yes, Ann. And when we propose a resolution to the city council of Berkeley, and we say, this is this and this, and then and at the bottom we say, and send a copy, they say, oh, yes, I know, we'll send it to the UN. I mean, it's possible for people to comprehend it. Sacramento, California, U.S., UN. It exists, and it is not just the Security Council. I'm going to give you another brief test. There are six organs of the United Nations. How many can you list? An organ is a body, just like legislative, executive, and judicial. In the UN, tell me one organ.
UNICEF?
What?
UNICEF?
No, UNICEF is not actually. It's an agency.
World Health Organization?
What?
World Health.
No, those are all agencies, and you've heard of them, and I'm glad you have. Yes.
Nope,
that's another agency. The World Court is one of six. You got five to go. What's the one you always hear about? The Security Council. Name another.
General Assembly.
Come on, Kofi Annan.
Oh.
Secretary General. You got two to go. Okay, now here is the joke. And here we call ourselves Marxists. One of the six organs of the United Nations is called the Economic and Social Council. And when the UN was established, the concept was that the Economic and Social Council would be as important as the Security Council. What can be more important than Economic and Social Council? How many of you are members of something called a non-governmental organization? You all are. I mean, virtually everybody. Article 71, I think it's on that sheet of paper. Is Article 71 on there? I don't know if I got it on.
Yes.
Okay, do you want to read it to us?
The Economic and Social Council may make suitable arrangements for consultation with non-governmental organizations which are concerned with matters within its competence. Such arrangements may be made with international organizations and, where appropriate, with national organizations after consultation with a member of the United Nations concerned.
My friends, that's where the word came from. Now, you've all read the First Amendment. Let's see. Somebody read the First Amendment. First Amendment, loud and clear.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or the press, or the right of people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for redress of their.
So the First Amendment talks about the right of the people peaceably to assemble, to petition the government for a redress of grievances. It doesn't say the government has to listen. The United Nations says the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations, one of six, shall listen to organizations, shall meet with them. And in fact, that happens every year. So I would the sixth organization of the UN, the sixth organ, is the Trusteeship Council. And guess what's happened? From the time in 1945 when the UN began until today, virtually every colony, except Puerto Rico and Guam, has stopped being a colony, is now a nation. And the U.S. government said, we won't talk to the Trusteeship Council. But where we got all of these little countries is they used to be colonies, and now they are separate nations. I'm not saying it's perfect, but I'm saying they're all there. And each one has a vote in the General Assembly. And that vote is equal to the vote of the United States in the General Assembly. So those are the six organs of the UN. And I am suggesting to you that this is a good time to start. When you say, I have a right under the First Amendment, you can add an Article 55 of the UN Charter. It comes trippingly off the tongue. And if your lawyer doesn't understand it, give them that sheet of paper or tell them to buy that book. And if a judge doesn't understand it, they can learn to understand it. And I can tell you that this actually works. They were going to close the schools in Richmond, California, many years ago. and because they had run out of money. And it meant the kids in Richmond would not be treated equally with kids anywhere else. And it was a rich and middle and poor neighborhood, all three. And in the end, we all went to the trial, and I came and represented Micklejohn, and I said, in addition to all the other things that are wrong with this, it violates the UN Charter because it discriminates on the basis of race, and it violates the concept of the Article 55. And you know what? The judge liked it. Now, it's the problem with raising all these issues is that they now admit that the UN Charter exists sometimes, but they're not going to put it in a written opinion. So she thanked me privately for saying this, but she didn't decide it on that basis. But it helped, it puts this problem in Richmond into a bigger context. And I believe that that is what a Marxist needs to do today, to think about the political and economic issues and think about the structure of government, which includes the United Nations, and think about how to use these kinds of laws. I'm going to tell you Oig Vey, and then I'm going to stop. I don't know, have any of you heard of Oig Vey? I just invented it, actually. OIG, Oig Vey. OIG stands for the Office of Inspector General, and it's another new law you can use. You've been reading the papers, right, that the EPA, OIG, has said that the government lied, remember, about the danger of working at Ground Zero? And the other day they said that the OIG said that they lied about the cost of Medicare. And another OIG said that they lied about the treatment of detainees in New York and New Jersey. My friends, every single federal agency, the little ones, the big ones, both kinds, have an OIG. Every single federal agency since 1978 has had an Office of Inspector General. So when you're angry at, I don't know, I'm making it up about Oakland, Sacramento, I'll say it about Oakland. If the Oakland police use rubber bullets, which they got from the federal government, you could write a complaint to the Department of Defense or the Department, the Civil, Justice Department, Criminal Division, complaining about their sending rubber bullets to the Oakland Police Department under the Office of Inspector General, and they're going to have to make a report. Have any of you ever heard of John Conyers? Well, he, believe it or not, is vice chair of the Judiciary Committee of the House, and every OIG report goes to the chair and the vice chair of the Judiciary Committee of the House and Senate. So if you have a problem in Sacramento with something that's happening in Washington with a particular agency, or that agency is helping somebody in Sacramento do something bad, you can write a letter of complaint to the OIG of that department or agency and send a copy to John Conyers, which he's going to get anyway, and send it to the newspapers. You are enforcing existing law. I think I've said enough, but you get the idea.